Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. I'm Dennis Wu, and I'm in the house with Nomi Rojas. Welcome aboard once again, Nomi. How's everything?
Good, Dennis. I'm Nomi. I'm the editor of Synapse, the region's life sciences news digest. And today I bring with me Dr. Ogechika Alozi. He is an MD and MPH. He's an assistant professor of infectious disease at Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center at El Paso, Paul L. Foster School of Medicine, in the Department of Internal Medicine. He's also chief medical informatics officer. Is that also at the medical school?
It is.
And he's the director of HIV clinical services, also at the medical school.
Yep, that's correct.
But you practice at UMC, University Medical Center?
I do. I practice both at the University Medical Center and at Texas Tech's Physicians Clinic. So thank you both for having me here this morning or afternoon.
Well, we wanted to talk to you because it's a timely discussion to talk about infectious disease and the things that are happening with Ebola. Do you get a lot of people calling and asking you if they have it, or?
You know, interestingly enough, I have had a few calls of people sort of panicked, some anxiety with all the press coverage that's been going around the country, and just asking, hey, is it possible that somebody actually has Ebola in El Paso? My response to them has been pretty unlikely. And if they did, have they come from West Africa? Have they come from Sierra Leone, Liberia? And luckily for us in El Paso, we've not had that issue yet, so.
Because they're screening them in West Africa. They don't let them leave.
Very true. Okay. Very, very true.
Let's just educate people here a little bit on how do you get it, what are the symptoms, and things like that.
Definitely. So Ebola, or Ebola hemorrhagic fever, it's a virus. So it's one of five strains. Present strain that's going on right now has five different classes. This is just one of them. And it's one of those viruses that you can't catch in the air. So I think that's really important for people to understand that this is not a thing where somebody next to you has a cough or they have the sniffles or they're a little bit sick. People with Ebola become very sick. It's in blood, it's in urine, tears, feces. People that get Ebola develop this rash. That's kind of where the hemorrhagic rash starts from. And their skin starts to slough off. There's a lot of blood involved, bleeding. And so somebody with Ebola that is contagious is not the same person that would be walking around doing their daily activities, going to work, having childcare. If you really look back, so just sort of background, Ebola is a virus. First outbreak was in 1976, I think, in the Democratic Republic of Congo. We're not really sure where it came from, whether it's bats, monkeys, forest. A lot of people talk about the removal of the forest around a lot of villages. So as all these rural areas start to grow and their populations expand, and we kind of cut down trees and take out the natural habitats of animals, it may have come through there. The thing, however, to really think about is that people that get Ebola, for the main part, are people that are giving intimate care to the sick. So we're talking about healthcare workers, missionaries, relief workers, and then the family members of persons that have Ebola. Another thing that has been seen to happen is when they're burying these people, because for years, the fatality rate of Ebola was around 90%. I mean, it's a terrible disease to have. People that were buried in the process of preparing their bodies for funeral and washing them, cleaning them, dressing up, the morticians or the people that ran the morgues in these rural areas, they would get Ebola. And so that's how it would pass from person to person.
So when you say bodily fluids is how pretty much is how you get it. So what about sweat? Like if I get sweat on my hand and I rub my eye or something like that.
It is possible. I mean, anything is technically possible. Very difficult, though. So if you think about how a lot of epidemics, pandemics, outbreaks are spread person to person, something like SARS or even H1N1, when we talk about this so-called bird flu, it's because people cough. And it's because people cough and touch their hands and you have viral particles on your hands and I shake you or I shake Dennis. And that's how people get it, right? With this, it's a lot different. This is somebody that's bedridden, is bleeding, is having diarrhea, very, very high fevers and sickness. You and I aren't going to see that person for the most part, right? And even if I were to see that person in the hospital, if we really did think it was an Ebola patient, we'd be wearing hazmat suits, not just gloves and a gown. We'd be wearing hazmat level 3 suits.
And like they would probably be quarantined.
Exactly. No, they would be quarantined. So I was joking with somebody the other day, if there truly was an outbreak in an emergency room in El Paso, we couldn't actually let those people go home. right? So we couldn't let the people in that emergency room leave.
All the people in that emergency
room. They would actually be quarantined. The whole emergency room would probably be shut down. Now, and this is all theoretical. It's not going to happen. But if we truly were at that stage where you're talking about a virus that's so contagious and you have all these people in an emergency room, what happens if you let one go, right? They go home, spread it to their family. But luckily, those are the kind of things that happen in the Strain or science fiction movies.
The World Health Organization is talking about the possibility of using antibodies as the possible antidote, not necessarily the cure. How does that work?
So two ways. One thing that does happen is when we as individuals have any infection in general, our body creates an immune response. It happens with viruses specifically. And so with viruses, our body creates an antibody that's targeted towards that virus. One of the things that you may have heard on CNN, WHO, CDC websites is that the two Americans that they've actually brought back, the second one landed today, they're both at Emory, they've actually been treated when they were in West Africa with somebody's serum. So a 14-year-old boy that actually survived Ebola, his body produced antibodies, and so they actually gave them that serum. The hope, and this hasn't been proven anywhere, right? So the hope is that the antibodies from that child's blood are able to counteract the Ebola in these victims' blood, right? And so that's sort of the whole antibody theory. Going down the line into the future, you talk about what are called monoclonal antibodies, and so where you can take antibodies that you know attack Ebola and then mass produce them. So we sort of produce what we do in cancer. So we already have targeted antibodies that we already use in cancer. There's also a drug that has been used. It's very, very early stages by the National Institutes of Health, the NIH. I can't remember the number of it, but it cured 14 out of 15 macaque monkeys that actually had Ebola. And so it's never been used in human beings. There's some information on the blogosphere and Twitter and the rest that it may have been given to these people, but that hasn't been confirmed or substantiated yet.
Yeah, that one where helped the primates.
Exactly.
They want to move it on to
human trials.
Clinical trials.
Exactly.
And
exactly.
Will that happen? Or?
You know, you never know. One of the things that for most medications that you and I would get, I mean, I take a blood pressure medication I have for years. My patients that are on HIV medications, hepatitis C therapies, all those medications have gone through the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, and so they've gone through years and years of testing and very rigorous scientific evaluation.
And it's very expensive.
Very expensive. We're talking about billions of dollars. Is it possible that the NIH or the CDC or the WHO could make exceptional circumstances? These are extraordinary circumstances. You have to remember that this is the most deadly and largest epidemic of Ebola in the last 40 years. And so is it possible they could make an exception? Potentially. Would that be the standard that we usually do for most medications? Not at all.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. Where are you from?
I have a very interesting background. So I was originally born in Nigeria. I came to the United States when I was 4 years old, a long time ago. My mom and dad were actually PhD students at the University of Minnesota.
So you grew up in Minnesota?
I did grow up in Minnesota.
I lived in Minnesota for
really?
A little while.
Really? Where?
St. Cloud.
Oh, I lived in St. Paul. I grew up in St. Paul.
That's like 45-minute
drive.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I was in Minneapolis before I moved to El Paso. But unfortunately, my father passed away when I was 4 years old. So it was just me and my mom. At some point in time when I was a junior in high school, she felt it would be best for me to get to know my family. I had a lot of extended family in Nigeria. And so she actually sent me home to a boarding school in Nigeria where I finished up my junior and senior years. I went to medical school in Nigeria. In Nigeria, medical school is about 6 years. I worked for a while doing some public health things, rural health, and I just realized that I really didn't have the skills that I needed to be really involved in public health. And so I came back to Minnesota, went to the University of Minnesota, got a master's in public health in infectious disease epidemiology. And right across the river from the University of Minnesota is a huge county hospital. It's called Hennepin County Medical Center. It's actually a very highly rated hospital in the country. And that's where I did my residency, then went back across the bridge to the University of Minnesota and did my infectious disease fellowship before finally moving to El Paso in 2010.
What got you interested in working in public health in the first place? I mean, going back home, you know, is one thing, but you had a myriad of things you could have chosen. And this sounds like a calling.
You know, I really think it is. At one point in my life, I thought I was going to be a cardiologist or a sports medicine doctor. A lot of my colleagues that I went to medical school with, if they see me after 20 years, they're like, I thought you wanted to be a cardiologist. I thought you were going to do sports medicine. And towards the end of my medical school, I just realized that I really enjoyed public health. I realized I liked learning about malaria and tuberculosis. And HIV was one of those things, very secretive in Nigeria at that point in time. We had wards of people that were dying of HIV. We didn't have medications. And it kind of triggered something in me to do more. Even when I returned to the States and I started doing my MPH, initially I wanted to do cardiovascular epidemiology, but sometime along there, my mom's sister actually contracted HIV. And so that kind of was the turning point for me. I already had an affinity to public health, but specifically HIV and infectious diseases was sort of that, just kind of figuring out what she was doing, what was going on with her, how to help her as little as I could. And you know how it is. You're a student and you don't have a lot of money. But that for me was a turning point. And ever since then, I've been excited. I think one of the things that you mentioned, the other part of my job, the chief medical informatics officer, really allows me to begin to use data and information. So, I mean, as you know, your bank or Google or Yahoo, they have billions of bits and pieces of information about you. That same information we have on infectious diseases, right? So the CDC uses this information. The NIH uses this information. And for me, it's just really cool to be able to try to tie my epidemiological background plus infectious diseases and sort of try to make predictions on how are our patients going to do? How are my hepatitis C patients going to do? How are my HIV patients going to do? And I'm sure that the CDC and WHO, that's the data that they're using to predict the Ebola outbreak, right? So they're seeing the case fatality rates, how many people have it, how many people are actually dying. It's estimated that the case fatality rate now in West Africa is actually about 50 to 55%, which is actually lower than it has most times. It may be that the viral strain has gotten less hardy or wholesome. It's not as strong. I think another thing some people have pointed out, though, is that we have better medicine, right? We have better medical care. Whereas before, you had to be in Europe. You had to be in the United States to get high-quality intensive care units. Now you can move those, right? So there are mobile intensive care units. People can get so-called supportive care a lot easier than you could 10, 20 years ago.
So what brought you to why El Paso? I mean, I'm sure you could have gone anywhere.
Yeah, at that point in time, it was one of those things where as I started to look around and look for a job, my calling was HIV, right? And so I could, like you said, I could have gone a lot of places, but I wanted to go somewhere where I could sort of do my own thing, where I could begin to grow a clinic. And so I was very lucky at that point in time, the dean at Texas Tech, Paul Foster School of Medicine, and my chairman, internal medicine, Dr. Richard McCallum, who recruited me, we were lucky to come across the grant. So there's a Ryan White grant, and it's based out of Lubbock, but they wanted another site outside of Lafay, right? So Lafay is a great clinic, huge population, but they also wanted something tied to the university. And so they approached Dr. McCallum at that point and said, hey, we'd be willing to open a HIV clinic at Texas Tech if you have a provider. It was almost serendipitous that at that point in time I was interviewing, and he said, hey, I just got a call a few days ago. Would you be interested in opening a clinic? So we opened, I think, October 1st of 2010 with 12 patients.
It's an HIV clinic, here in El Paso.
Here in El Paso at Texas Tech.
Is it the Alberta location?
The Alberta location, okay. Exactly. In the 4801 Alberta Avenue, upstairs on the second floor. That's where we run our clinic. We started just by myself with 12 patients initially. A few months later, we got a social worker, case manager, and we've grown from there. I mean, from 12 to 50, 50 to 150, 200. We ran numbers a few weeks ago, and we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 450 to 500 patients. And so we've had...
What's the age?
Have patients all the way from, I have a 3-month-old that's enrolled in my clinic that I don't technically see. Dr. Handel does that in pediatrics. And I have a 71-year-old or 72-year-old male that I also see. And his issues aren't HIV. I mean, he has some colon issues. He's high blood pressure, diabetes. But we have a host of patients. I'd say the thing that concerns me or even scares me recently is that majority of my patients are under 30. And I'd actually say under 25. Somewhere between the ages of 16 to 25, and it's probably a national epidemic. It's really sad that we have young people who seem to have missed that message of safe sex and using a condom and protection. And so I have a lot of young kids that come in with HIV these days.
Do you think that the media is partially responsible for not helping put the word out on that sort of thing? Seems like, honestly, commercial media especially, we've been lax in telling kids, hey, listen, if you practice this, you won't get that.
You know, it's controversial. I think my take on it, and I give these talks to high schools and colleges across the country, actually, is we've missed a generation in terms of our message, If you really think about it, in the 80s and 90s, be it Rock Hudson or Eric Wright, who was Eazy-E in that hip-hop phase, a host of persons that were high-profile, very popular, had HIV. And so for me, growing up, I saw Rock Hudson, I saw Eazy-E, I saw a host of other people.
That basketball player,
Magic
Johnson.
Thank you very much. You know, all these people had HIV or on TV. And so a generation grew up in the 80s and 90s that always talked about condoms, always talked about sex. Because we've been so successful with treatment of HIV and there's a host of medications and the side effects are very minimal, we're down to being able to take one pill once a day. We haven't had that conversation. And so there's a host of people that have grown up now that just don't really think about sex as a risk factor, right? And that's the same reason that that same age group, probably 13 to 30, has the highest rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea and syphilis across the country. We've sort of missed the message with young kids today in terms of talking about sex and the consequences of sex.
So it comes right back to the parent, actually, to be able to talk about the birds and the bees and what you can contract from that.
It does. I mean, you know, in as much as I'm a parent now, and so I dread when I have to talk to my 8-year-old daughter someday about the birds and the bees. But it does. I mean, I don't think that we can allow the schools to be responsible for the training of our kids, right? I mean, that's a conversation that's gone on for decades. I also think today it's a lot easier to quote-unquote hook up. Mm-hmm. Right. So 20 years ago, if you wanted to have sex, you had to go to a bar or go somewhere else and talk and buy multiple drinks and et cetera, et cetera. Now, kids have apps. I mean, I have clients that come in and they say, oh, yeah, I have 20 people that I have a possibility of hooking up with at noon. Mm-hmm. And they're there for a 10 o'clock clinic. And I'm like, oh, my goodness. And so that's scary. But you think about that, just sort of like Ebola. Right. Let's tie this back to Ebola. The fact that that person has access to 20 other people within a very short time is the same way within Ebola in a healthcare setting, because there's so many people that are sick and have fevers. And remember, in West Africa, there's a host of things that can cause fever. I mean, Lassa fever, malaria, tuberculosis, common cold. And so you have all these people that are coming into a clustered area that can get sick from Ebola. In the United States and in industrialized countries, you have all these kids that have access to clusters of people that they can have sex with very easily.
Well, in case you're just joining us, we're talking to Dr. Alozi. He is a infectious disease specialist here in El Paso. I wanted to ask you about how vulnerable El Paso is to Ebola, because if you think about it, we're a very international city. I mean, you know, we had the influx of immigrants. They probably require some medical attention. We have Fort Bliss, soldiers coming in and out from the Middle East and other countries. And so, I mean, how vulnerable is El Paso compared to other parts of the country?
Yeah, great question. I think that if I were to rate El Paso's vulnerability compared to a Miami or an Atlanta or a New York or Chicago, probably not the same, right? So if you think about the international travelers that come through El Paso, they're not coming from West Africa for the most part. I mean, people like me, we come to El Paso, but even when I go back to Nigeria, I'm going through Atlanta, or I'm going through Dallas, or I'm going through New York. And so that's the first port of call. And if I were sick in any of those areas and I show a green passport, which is a Nigerian passport, I'll be flagged. I'll be put aside. I'll be screened. I'll have my temperature taken, asked multiple questions. So there's already that layer of filtering before an El Pasoan would get back to El Paso. The other thing, and you bring up a very interesting point about the military, right, Fort Bliss. We have multiple conflicts around the world that the Army is fighting. But what's interesting enough is that there aren't a lot of conflicts in West Africa that Fort Bliss soldiers are involved in. So this isn't Afghanistan or Iran or Iraq or a host of other places in the Middle East and the Far East that they're engaged in. In Guinea, Liberia, Sierra Leone, we don't really have a lot of American soldiers. And so that extra risk of having ground forces in those countries isn't there. And so I think that, in a sense, it's lucky, right? We don't have direct flights coming in from West Africa. The other question then becomes, what about the Mexican border, right? And so as of now, there aren't a lot of persons or risk of people coming straight from West Africa to Mexico itself. And even if they were, they'd go to Mexico City. Then from Mexico City, they'd have to get to Ciudad Juarez before coming across. And so we have a bunch of almost natural screens and filters put in place before somebody would actually show up in El Paso.
So even though we're on the border, we're pretty padded.
In a sense.
Yeah.
In a sense, we are, just because of the geography of where Ebola is right now.
Yeah, and all now, the layovers.
If Ebola was in Mexico City, or if Ebola was in South America, Central and South America, a whole different conversation we'd be having right now, right? Mm. But because of where it is in West Africa, I think it provides an extra buffer for us.
Well, we've had rains over the last few days, and so the media, and I know I'll be looking at the possibility of West Nile starting to crop up again. What is West Nile? What do we look for? How do we get rid of it?
So I'm going to answer the last question first, right? How do you get rid of it? Get rid of stagnant water. And that's really what it boils down to.
And there's a lot of that now because it's been raining a lot.
Everywhere, yeah. But, you know, one of the things about it, though, in as much as, yes, it's large bodies of water, a lot of it's smaller bodies of water, right? So tires, cans, people leaving pans or buckets out wherever they may be. That's a lot of what drives the mosquito vector, right? And so just that alone can reduce immensely the amount of West Nile that's out there. The other thing, too, is just vigilance. Just like in any other infectious condition, it's vigilance. If you have a fever, if you start to feel sick, especially in people that are older, right? So remember, West Nile typically is worst in people that are older and very young. And so if you're in your 60s and 70s, have multiple medical issues, if you have a child at home and in the West Nile season, which essentially now, and they start getting a fever, whatever it may be, you need to take them into your doctor. I think you have to have that extra level of vigilance. Unfortunately, no great treatment for West Nile, right? And so, again, it's one of those supportive diseases where we give people IV fluids, pain medication, fever medications, but there's no quote-unquote treatment for it. And so it's very difficult to really combat.
I've walked into several hospitals lately. I've been visiting friends or friends and relatives in the hospitals for various maladies. And what I see now are stations where you have the little Purell.
Mm-hmm.
Little signs that says prevent MRSA.
Exactly.
You know, wash your hands constantly.
Exactly.
So I'm going by every station just washing my hands all of a sudden. It's like, and it's not, I like every station I have to do this because I feel like I'm being watched to do it. Well, what is MRSA?
So MRSA stands for methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. It's a mouthful for a bacteria. It's essentially a bacteria. Now, one of the things, and, you know, I'm probably jaded. I'm that cynical, quote-unquote, old guy almost, because I see so much of it that I sometimes think, really? But the thing is this. If you really go back to when MRSA was that national conversation in the national stage, it was because kids were getting it, right? So the babies that died, I think, in North Dakota, in Minnesota, way back when, was specifically because it affected kids. MRSA is a bacteria, it's contact. And so that's why the whole hand washing is key. All those containers of Purell or the foams that you see in various hospital settings or clinical settings, they have alcohol in them. They're all alcohol-based. And so alcohol kills that MRSA.
Isn't MRSA like a hospital thing?
So MRSA is two types. You can have the hospital-acquired MRSA and the community-acquired MRSA. The one we as providers sort of, we still fear it, but we used to fear it a lot, was community-acquired MRSA because it was actually more rapid. So, and remember, too, that people get a bump or a blister on their body, and they kind of ignore it, right? We get bumps and knocks and scrapes all the time. But like you said, because it's the quote-unquote flesh-eating or very rapidly progressive bacteria, it can really do damage to somebody's skin in under 24 to 48 hours. And so by the time they get to the hospital, they're very sick. And then we're fighting a battle that's sort of already been progressed, and we're always trying to catch up. I think the biggest thing for people to do is, you know, a lot of the people that get MRSA are athletes. So close contact. So whether you have prisons, army quarters, high school gyms. Oh, God. High school gyms have a host of bacteria there. But, I mean, new towels, wash your hands. Just stay clean, really. And if you do have, quote, unquote, the snake bites or the spider bites, whatever it is, that's a lot of what we get. People come in, well, I was bitten by a spider. Well, they didn't really see a spider, but they make an assumption that it was a spider. It's probably just MRSA. But staph in general is a very rapidly destructive bacteria, and if it progresses, it can make people very sick. You look like you're
wow.
in shock.
Well, I'm thinking of my elementary-aged kids, and yeah, I mean, sometimes you walk into the gym and it kind of smells, and, and I'm like, are you guys keeping this place clean?
Well, I got a better one for you. You know, I take public transportation. No slam on public transportation. But some of the people who ride public transportation aren't exactly hygienically clean.
Fair enough.
So when they sneeze in their hand and then they grab onto that bar, okay?
Don't even get me started how many bacteria and microbes are probably on that bar. But
well, maybe you should.
Like I said, I think the most important thing, though, is just cleaning your hands, right? Washing your hands often. You know, there's also a controversy about whether those Purell containers at home or the whole antiseptic soaps that we use, whether those actually do more damage. Because always remember, our bodies are really good at naturally protecting us. And so our bodies have a layer of skin and bacteria that actually protects us. And the more we use some of those alcohol-based and antibacterial soaps and wipes, we're actually reducing that layer. So there's a fine balance between doing what's necessary to prevent infection if you're out and about and in contact with people, and necessarily at home where you would hope that the people in your household are relatively clean, right? Having to do that 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 times a day. And so there's just that kind of fine balance. I always tell people, be vigilant, be careful where you can. Don't necessarily overdo it. I mean, we have to use common sense in some things.
You know, back in I'm showing my age, but there used to be a when I was growing up, there was a soap called Physohex, and it was made out of hexachlorophene.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I mean, if you had measles, mumps, whatever, mom just bathed
you
in this stuff.
In it.
Oh, big time. And all of a sudden, 2 days later, you're good. But no one figured that hexachlorophene was going to be an active ingredient that would start a carcinogen in the body that would actually lead to cancer.
Yep.
And so that's why hexachlorophene got pulled off the shelves. And it's kind of sad on the one side because it was so beneficial, but on the other side, it was so deadly.
Yeah. I mean, if you really think about it, too, that sort of plays into the dearth or the lack of antibiotics that we have right now. So in the last 3 or 4 years, maybe there's been 4 or 5 new antibiotics. And if you look at what's called the so-called pipeline for new antibiotics going into the future, there aren't a lot there. And so we're coming up against a situation where, yes, we have antibiotics to treat most infections, but we're beginning to not have antibiotics to treat certain infections. And so the MRSA is one of them, really, where we start to get worried because the methicillin resistance, our drug of choice is what's called vancomycin. There are some places in the country that now have vancomycin resistance. If that becomes standard in multiple emergency rooms and hospitals across the country, we don't have a good alternative. The even more frightening one is something called ESBL, and that's a bacteria that really, if you look at it, has no good treatment. There's one class of medications left, and the next drug that we use to treat it causes a lot of kidney failure. And so when I have to put patients on that medication, I always consult my nephrology or my renal colleagues and tell them, hey, I anticipate that in the next 3 to 5 days, this person's kidney function is going to get much worse, and we just need to watch it and see what's going on. So I think, again, it's due diligence. You have to be careful. You have to try to avoid things. You can't live your life in a bubble. Mm. And so I'm not saying don't go bike riding, skiing, shopping, whatever the case may
right.
be. But it means due diligence. If you see something, say something.
Cool deal.
Thank you, Dr. Alozi, for talking with us. Thank you, Dennis, for allowing me to bring the doctor on your show.
Oh, listen, anytime, mi casa su casa, would I have you. And thank you, listeners. And thank you, listeners, for another edition of El Paso Primetime. Special thanks to Nomit Rojas, who's producer of this particular episode of El Paso Primetime. Also, special thanks to Deidre Westenhauser for line producing a portion of this show as well. Thank you, the listener, for listening to El Paso Primetime.